it's wonderful being part of a Christian community that upholds their people. I know this morning and even last night already, I felt like I could feel people holding me up in prayer. And those of you who did, thank you for that. I think I'm gonna actually start this class with a little prayer. Dear God, thanks so much for each one of us that's here. And you know that this incredible diversity that is here today and the many types of personalities that you've created in your for beauty and to bring perfection to the earth. And thank you for that. And please be with me as I give this talk. And you know that I have so many issues that myself to be up here trying to address these people. But please be with this class and help your power to be upon it. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. So the little blurb that went with my story talked about knowing your character, being able to ask some questions, and knowing your character so well. And there's a couple different ways to go about this. One of them is to observe real people. But that's problematic because the real people that you're observing might not be the type of people you want to observe. But there's another significant problem. What's real and what isn't? Let me tell you about somebody I know. You decide. I'm going to tell you, first person, you try to decide, is this a real person or not? So I'm going to go visit him, and I come driving in the lane, and he comes walking out, and he's got these old cowboy boots on, and his pants are blue. They're blue jeans. So blue jeans are supposed to be blue, right? Well, they're blue, but something's a little awkward, a little weird about these blue jeans. And maybe this old leather coat on, and he has his father's set of Air Force wings. And the pin came off the back of him and they fell down. This is an old man, maybe 70 years old. And the pin came off him, they fell off, and he lost them. He found his father's Air Force wings again. So he took a drill and he drilled right through the front of this set of wings from World War II and stuck a brass bolt through it and bolted it to the front of his coat. And maybe have one of the little flat brim hats on like ship captains are supposed to wear or whatever. And he comes out and, oh, how are you? And then maybe he's trying to figure out what your income level is and all those important things. And so you go see his house and you walk around the corner and there's this old dumpy kind of looking shop with junk sitting everywhere. This place doesn't belong to him. It's just one of his friends. So you go around back and he's got this old broken down camper tucked around the corner. And he's got these IBC totes. If you know what they are, they're shipping totes about this big. And they have a metal screen cage around them. And they're plastic insert. And he had cut the top out of them. He had lined them up under the drip edge of this shop. Oh, so, yeah, he says, I'm recycling water. I can take these pants and this shirt when they get dirty. And I can wash them out in these IBC crates. And his TV set up in there. And the cat maybe comes out from under his old dumpy trailer. And he's talking. And look at what I got going on here. And he takes this old VW car, like a GW Golf, and he'd taken a sawzall and cut the thing in half. And he had the back end blocked up, had the drive shaft sticking out the back, and he had an airplane propeller attached to it because he wanted to see, you know, how this is all going to work. He likes airplanes. He'd been a crop duster pilot for years. And you can reach up in there and wham, wham with a stick or something to make the accelerator go. This airplane propeller is spinning and blowing bits of junk bolts and stuff out of the car, and it's just flying through the propeller, whack, whack. Oh, I just broke the propeller, piece of junk. It wasn't mine anyway. Well, okay. And then he says, what do you think about my pants? Like, well, I wasn't quite sure what to think. Well, he said they got dirty. They got stained, and I couldn't. He said, so I just painted them blue. That's why the light reflected off of them with kind of that look, you know. Okay, yeah. I guess that would work. Well, I gotta go. So he goes over, and he gets in his car. All this car. It's a big boat of like a Lincoln Continental. And it's sitting like this, nose down, because it's got a big set of Mudder pickup tires on the back. It's still got the little street tires on the front. And you're looking at this thing. Seems to be some extra features going on here. Like, so he's got this this rack, you know, like a luggage rack. You slip in the recess hitch on the back of the vehicle. They're about this wide and yay deep. He's got that on the back. And of course, it's tilted up kind of like this because the car's tilted like that. It's got this piece of PVC pipe tied down to the rack. And it goes up over the roof of the car, down the other side, and it's tied off on the big old hood ornament. What's that for? Oh, he says it gets a jug of oil on a rack, whoosh, on that pipe. So, Jesus, watch. He gets in the car, out the lane, and gets lined up. This building, this place where he's living, is next door to, right second to next door to a national wildlife refuge that happens to be in between him and where he wants to go. So, well, you could go all the way around it, but there's dirt roads across it. Unfortunately, there's a cable gate. He's got that one figured out. Wah, right up to it. And that PVC pipe that's sticking down over the nose, it picks that cable gate up. Wah, and the gate kind of goes up and drops down behind it. Poof, poof, and wah, he goes down the muddy road. The reason the gate might be shut is because the road's too muddy, you know. He's throwing fantails out the back. Wah, with his little front wheels trying to steer in the big mudders, throwing mud out the back. Now you tell me, if I made him up, how many of you think I made him up? How many of you think he's real? He's real. Now let me introduce you to another character. This is actually one of my friends. It's somebody I like. He is that first man would take advantage of you if you could. This man would help you if he could. He's an intellect. Very smart, knows. One day I said, how many languages do you know? Well, he said theirs, and he started down the list, and he named off 8 or so. And then later he said, yeah, and I went to this hymn sing, and it was in one of the Scandinavian languages, which wasn't on the list of what he had named. And he said, I like that one song they had, so I've been translating it into English. And I thought, wait, you didn't tell me you knew that language, too. Maybe he's using a book. I don't know. But he has this van, and it looks kind of like my vehicles tend to get looking. You know, there's a lot of stuff in there. And he said, hey, I brought these books for you. So he reaches in the back and pulls the books out. There's a lot of stuff in the back. And, oh, there's these crackers, and here, there's something for the girls, and he's pulling it out. My little girl, after we left, she said, Mom, when I grow up, I want a van like that. He can just reach behind the seat and get anything he needs. Very, very smart intellectual person. He's just not concerned with that sort of thing because what difference does it make? I mean, is it important to him? No. And some people, they live in their heads. And as long as the furniture up there is organized correctly, they're happy. I mean, what does the rest of this stuff have to do with anything anyway? And I've thought to myself, and if the furniture in my head is not organized right, whose fault is that? It's hard writing about real people, unless you're actually going to write about this person, just pulling them, putting them in your stories, man, because we don't see people. We see stereotypes, and that is unfortunately true. We look at somebody and we see the old lady in the wheelchair, the fat policeman with the donut, whatever it is, and we don't actually really see people. And I know you're thinking, no, I see people. So let me tell you about this test. I think it was Barbara and Alan Pease were talking about it in their book on body language. They did this test where they set up it was an information booth, like where you come to a tourist attraction, you could get the flyer on this, flyer on that. And they had this man standing here. Maybe he looked like me, brown hair, blue shirt. Okay? And you would come up and you would say, I would like a flyer on the Grand Canyon. Sure, I can get that for you. So he would, it's behind the counter. He'd bend down to get it and jog off to the side. And there's another man right here that's blonde hair, white shirt. He moves over with the flyer in his hand, stands up, here's a flyer. Like 50% of the people never even caught on. They were talking to a completely different person with different color hair, different color shirt. Never got it. We tend to not see things. We see the person behind the counter. And we're going to have to pay a lot better attention than that if we're going to actually write about people. It did another. There was another cool one. I listened to the Great Courses. They were talking about, it was the same idea. They would have a student standing there, and a man would come up to him and say, "Hey, I need to know how to get down to Market Street." "Okay, well, you go down here and you make a left turn," and about that time, two workmen carrying a door would walk right in between it. It would last 1 second. In the meantime, they switched out the person on the back, and the person's still standing there waiting for an answer. It's a completely different person. And something like 40% of the people didn't realize they were talking to a different person. It might have been closer to half. I don't remember. No, I think it was 40% realized they were talking to a different person. It was closer to center. And so they said, "Well, what would happen if we would stereotype this a little more?" So they put a set of work boots on this man and a hard hat. And they had him come up, "Hey, how do I get to Market Street?" "Well, you go down here and make a left-hand turn, and here comes a door that goes by in front of him. And there's a person standing there in work boots and a hard hat." Different person. Only 30% of people picked it up. One out of three realized they were talking to a completely different person. So it can be hard to draw characters out of real life because we so often don't see them. And I know you're thinking, "Well, I would." And so they ask a whole class of people, "Would you see it?" And they all said, "Yeah, we would have. Totally, we would have seen that." But statistically, it was one out of three that would have noticed. Okay, so that's one way to do it, and it's a hard way. Because of our own, if you're very observant, this could work very well for you. There's two other ways I want to bring out, though. The first one is the archetypes. Now, if you've ever read, like, The Writer's Journey, that's where this is drawn from. And there was a man by the name of Joseph Campbell who said, "What if there is a storyline that supersedes all storylines, a major universal story that all their stories get their energy from?" And this isn't a class on plot, so we're not going to spend a lot of time on plot, but I need to explain just enough of it so you know where these characters are coming from. He said, "What if there is?" He was studying all the myths from all around the world, and by myth, that could be the story of Jonah and the whale, even the story of Jesus Christ, but stories. And he said there is a central story that stories all over the world tie back into. And he had this little looked a little bit like this. Wasn't intending to draw it out, but let's see if that works. Okay. Well, it's a circle like this. It's got a line struck through it. And your hero starts up here, and he comes down here, and he crosses a threshold. He comes down here, and then he ends up going back again. But as he goes around, he crosses like a threshold, and he gets into a place down here where he dies. In the story of Jesus Christ, it's very clear. And then they go through the death and resurrection. And then they come back to mankind with a boon. A boon is a great gift, something to return people with. And this basic storyline is repeated in variations all over the world and all over various cultures across time. And he said that's not an accident. And I don't believe it is an accident. I think that God has programmed into the human mind a certain way of thinking about stories to prepare him for Christ. That's just my personal opinion. But in these stories that go across the span of time, you have various individuals who play roles in this whole progression. The one of them is the hero. So let's talk about the hero first. And I want to look at various ways that these people show up in our lives. The hero could be us, could be me. It's the person who needs to change or needs to enact change. He is on a journey of change that needs to be he has needs to be met and flaws to be corrected and things that he needs to restore. He is somebody who is willing to sacrifice for the needs of others, though possibly not initially. This might be something that comes later as he goes through this whole progression. One pretty good example of the hero's journey is the story of Pilgrim's Progress. So you have the hero, this is who he is, and this is what he's doing. I think it's more interesting. You get into the mentor and how they come. And a mentor is somebody who instructs from often from a position of weakness. So what does that mean? Esther and Mordecai. So Esther's there. She's the queen. She's under the sovereign, but she has an enormous amount of power probably in her own right. She has people under her. And I don't know what all she could or couldn't do. But here is Mordecai, and he's sitting outside the gate. The people coming and going. And I don't know if he really amounts to much in terms of power. And this whole thing with Haman comes along, and Mordecai comes, sends a message to Esther. He said, this is what's going on. You need to go. And so he's sending her on a journey, but he's also mentoring her. He's sending, you need to go in and talk to the queen. And she sends back and says, that's candidly impossible, because nobody goes to see the king like that. And he comes back, and he's not in a position to order her. He's a mentor. The mentor serves as a conscience, too. He comes back to her and he says, God will save his people, but he can either do it through you, or deliverance will arise from some other way, but it won't will go well for you if it's not from you. And she says, okay, you call a day of fasting and prayer, I'll go. And she went. But that's how a mentor works. They're not in a position to tell your main character what to do. I am the mom. Clean up the living room. No. They're the one that say, maybe that old man that says, you know, you can leave the church if you want to, and nobody can stop you. But here's what I've observed happens to those who do. Your character makes a final choice, but he gets his conscience poked, and he gets his guidance from this mentor. There's another beautiful story we're all familiar with, and it's Ruth and Naomi. Ruth is a young, spry one here, and she's the one that could stay or go, but she's the one that goes out into the field and does the work. But she listens to her old mother-in-law, because her old mother-in-law knows things. And so when her old mother-in-law says, you go down to the threshing floor, imagine what's going through her mind. You go down to the threshing floor, and gave her the whole process there. She just did it. It was her choice. She didn't have to listen, but she did. And another case is God in the Garden of Eden, how he would come down and he would walk with him. He was in a position of authority, but he doesn't tell us what to do in the absolute. You will do this or that. He tells us this is what you should do. And here's the consequences if you do, and here's the consequence if you don't. But you're free to choose. The hero is always free to choose. Now here is, and call it the guardian of change. The writer's journey calls it the threshold guardian. This is an interesting idea, because if you look around you in life, you may see this, that just when we're getting up the nerve to do something, there's a crisis. There was a woman I know, came in from the outside, became a dear friend of one of my friends, and she had gotten pretty heavy. And she decided that what the Lord was leading her, she believed, to lose some weight because it was affecting her testimony. And she decided that's what the Lord was calling her to do. So I'm going to take her as a type. I'm going to make our hero here. Let's call her Mary. She's in this position. She's feeling like the Lord is asking her to. It's not something maybe she's superimposing on anybody else. Something the Lord is asking her to do. Okay? So she goes out and she gets all the diet books and studies and tries to find the best way to go about this, because she's on a journey for the Lord now. And this is serious. Finally, she finds a mentor, somebody who's been the way before, who knows about it, who can take her and say, yeah, this is what you need to do. This is what you don't need to do. She can find an ally, which you see further down, somebody who says, I'll walk this road with you. If you feel like that's what the Lord's calling you to do, I'll go with you. I've got your back. Everything's shaping up. It's Sunday afternoon. Monday morning, she's going to go across the threshold, and she's going to go on a diet. And she's decided that the diet that makes the most sense to her, it was recommended to her, is, say, the THM diet, the Trim Healthy Mama. A lot of you are probably familiar with that. And so she's got her the book laying here on the table, maybe closed like this. And slam there, because she's going to need it. And in comes her aunt Matilda, and she comes into the house with this grim expression on her face, kind of waddling in, looking at things, looking around. What's this all about? Trim, healthy, huh? They look like some worldly hussies. Let's see here. Yeah. She's going through this book. You know, when I was young, we didn't worry about this sort of thing. No, we ate what was put in front of us and we were thankful for it. The real problem with you young people today is you've got this idea of your image that's important to you. And if you would just submit to the church and put your shoulder to the wheel, you wouldn't be having all these identity issues. I think, as she's easing out the door, I think if you would just spend more time in prayer and solve all this. Boom, the door shuts. So what's your main character going to do? This is something that you feel like the Lord has called her to do. I'll tell you what she's going to do if she's normal. She's going to curl up in the biggest, softest armchair she can find. She's going to get some pulpy novel, and she's going to eat half a gallon of chocolate mint ice cream. That is a rational thing to do under those circumstances. It helps temporarily. Well, anyway, that woman, her Aunt Matilda, is a threshold guardian. The person, the crisis that comes just before you embark, or just as you embark upon something. And here's another example of it. A boy gets a call from the mission board. And they said, we've been noticing you, and we would like if you would come down to wherever, Argentina, and teach school for us down here. Would you consider it? Well, hadn't really thought about it. I'm working in my father's business, and I got a lot going on. But let me think and pray about it. So he prays about it, and he feels like he needs some counsel. So he goes to his mother. I mean, he goes to his ministry, and he asks his ministry. He trusts his ministry. Got a good relationship. Well, what do you think? Well, you know, I think it would be good for you, and I'll mostly think that you could do it. I feel like that would be a logical thing to do. I would encourage you to go in the ministry. Yeah, why don't you do it? I mean, if after a year it's not working out, you can come back. Or you'd be welcome back here. But why don't you try it? So, okay, well, he's going to try it. So he gets his passport, gets it all together. And about a week before he goes, his mom shows up. She's like, I've been thinking over this thing, and there's a lot of problems in Argentina. I mean, they've got a communist-style government, and they're... it's shaping up. It's not looking good, and it could all fall apart down there. And you could be like eating your boots, and you could be killed. I just don't think it. You know, she's thinking. What's she thinking? She's thinking of all those nights she spent up rocking this little baby to have him go down to Argentina and get shot full of holes. That doesn't seem reasonable. So she tells him so. So. We have two types of threshold guardians here. Now he's on the wire because he's been asked by the mission board to do it, and he's been asked the ministry encouraged him to do it. But his mother's telling him no, and she tells him your father's upset because he thinks you're leaving the family business, and he thinks you're being irresponsible or whatever. It's causing a bind up here. Now what's he going to do? That's a threshold guardian. It's a very real circumstance you can get into. It's a hard thing because the counsel of the ministry is important. But your parents, they raised you. That's hard. It's a hard problem. But these two types of threshold guardians are completely different. The Aunt Matilda is just a vengeful, old, bitter person who is taking out her pain on the rest of the world so that she can make everybody else as unhappy as she is. The mother is genuinely concerned, but they're both threshold guardians. The courier or the herald. Let's say you have a girl who is a young mother who's realized she's gotten into kind of a bad habit, a bad focus. And she has gotten very, very negative. I don't know if you've ever been through this. I have. It's not pretty. You go to church and just you go wherever. There's problems everywhere. Everything's painted in dark tones, and everybody's got problems. And hey, maybe you even got problems, but it's just all these people with all their problems sitting around. It's problems everywhere. And she's gotten into that really bad place that Satan likes to get us hooked into. And somebody could come up to her and say, listen, I've been noticing your attitude, and it's time you got over it. You're a mother. You've got children following after you. If you don't get a hold of this attitude, this is going to affect your family. That's a herald or a courier, somebody who brings you the news. These are not people, these things down the side. These are roles. So a person can go from a mentor, such as a mother or father, to a threshold guardian, such as I don't want you to leave the family and go to Argentina. They're roles that are played. Okay. So she said, you need to get over this. Or you can have the other type of threshold guardian, of courier or herald. And they come to you, and maybe a sweet old lady, and she says, you know, she said, I've just been thinking a lot about this life of joy, she said, and I just read this wonderful book. It's called 1,000 Gifts, and I have a copy, and I'd be so delighted to loan it to you. And you're like, yeah, you know, actually, I've been kind of struggling with this whole thing too. Yeah, I'd be glad to have it. Two completely different approaches for the same role. And the role is that of somebody who brings you the news you need to change. Let me show you how it works. Maybe in a little more real time, or another example of it. So this young woman, this mother, she goes to Sewing Circle, and she's sitting there, and she's still got this negative thing hanging over her head. She's thinking, I need to be positive. I read this book. It was a great book. I thought I could do it, but here I am. And the first thing she does, she sits down, and this person on this side of her is negative. He's talking about, oh, he had the stroke, and he's on dialysis, and this is terrible, and the world coming to an end. And the other one on the other side is interrupting her every half a sentence and just being obnoxious. She's thinking, oh, help. This is not what I need. This is not the answer. Here I am, and even these older ladies are just being negative. I can't find the help that I need in this church. And after a while, she looks across the quilt, and there on the other side is, say, one of her aunts, just kind of smiling, sewing, smiling. She's thinking, what are you smiling about? There's nothing to smile about. I mean, everybody's being negative. One person's interrupting. The other person's telling grisly tales. And some people get this wonderful joy or something out of telling grisly tales. And then everybody else has got to deal with it, right? And but what do they call them? War stories. And so she looks across. She thinks, why is my old aunt smiling while she's stitching? And after a while, she looks up and she says, ladies, do you get the ladies' journal? And a few of them are like, oh, yeah, we get it. Did you read that wonderful story in the last edition? Which one? Oh, and she goes on and she describes it in detail. And it's funny, and everybody breaks the mood and everybody's laughing. But your character, your hero, as it were, on the other side of the quilt is thinking, you know, that is a call. That's how it's done. She's calling me to higher ground because here I am, and I'm mucked up in the, I mean, I'm in the situation, and everybody's being negative, and all she can see is the negative, and somebody else from across the quilt calls her up and says, there is a way to hire her, and calls everybody up, but it's a personal call to her in her own mind. And she looks around, and she realizes there's another old saint down there, and she's sewing in her corner and having a real polite conversation about how they could meet the needs of this family that their house just burned down. And she realizes she's focusing on the wrong thing, that actually she's built, she has, by the people she calls and the people she's texted, she's built a little cartel of people around her that are negative. And it was not necessary. And all she has to do within this church is move into the circle of people that are living a life of joy. And she can find everything that she needs right here. Okay, that's the courier. Or the herald. Let's go to the shapeshifter. I love this one. This is somebody that runs hot and cold, or is unpredictable, or you're never quite sure where they're going to come out on any given day. These are problematic to put in stories, but they're great to put in stories. And the reason they're great is because they add tension to a story the same way they add tension to real life. How many of you know people? You don't have to raise your hand. How many of you know people that you never know when they come through the door? Is this up day or down day? Is this a left day or right day? Is this a, what's going on? And you kind of test the water for the first 30 seconds. Oh, this is an up day. Hey, how are you? It's great to have these people in your story because it can make your story tight and tense the same way it makes me tense in life when I'm never sure where he's going to come out. But the problem with it is people expect story characters to be consistent from one end to the other. I said this in my other class. I'll say it again. Probably not all of you were there. We don't want our reader thinking, what? I mean, this person was friendly 2 pages ago. Now he's upset and can't get along with him. Now he's friendly. Now he's upset. What's this? Is this writer? What was he doing when he wrote this? So you need to have something in there to let people know this character is not a good character being inaccurately portrayed, but a bad character being accurately portrayed. And a simple conversation between a husband and wife before bed, and they're talking, I don't know what to make out of. I don't know what to make out of Matilda. You know, some days she's up and some days she's down. Now your readers are like, okay, I got this. Yep, she reminds me of a couple people I know. Just don't leave your readers wondering about this character. Unless you leave them wondering the same way all the rest of us are wondering. And like, when she appears on the scene, it's, which way is it going today? Okay, I'll give you three examples on shapeshifters. One of them is a weak man. Let's say you have a school board meeting, and you have four men sitting around. You got the chairman, very conscientious type of person who likes to get everybody's opinion out on the table. And you got three other men, and they're discussing where to go for the school trip. And they decide they're going to the zoo. And then they're going to stop by the science exhibit on the way back. So, okay, and the chairman goes around. He says to the first man, I'm on board. Yeah, I think it's a good idea. And second man, everybody's on board. They maybe even vote on it. Put it in the minutes. Yeah, we decided on it. Unanimous vote. So the weak man goes home. What do you think happens? Well, the problem is his sister-in-law called his wife today and his wife thinks it's a bad idea because she heard about it when he comes home from work the next night. And she gets on his case. Or maybe his brother-in-law calls him on the job and tells him all the reasons why he shouldn't. So the next school board meeting, what happens? He's sitting over there. You know, I've been thinking about this. No, you haven't been thinking about this. You've been listening. But I've been thinking about this situation. I don't think going to the zoo is the right thing. This time of year, and he goes on down the line. And all the other men are looking at him thinking, brother, we all agreed on this. What is the problem? But they know what the problem is. The problem is he went home and got told what to think. It might have been by his wife. It might have been by his father-in-law. It might have been by his brother. But he came back with a whole different... And you probably know people like that, shapeshifters. They've got a story. It may be a coherent story. And it's just the same one that the last person they talked to had. That's one kind. Here's a lot worse kind. Wait a minute. That's pretty bad. Here's another kind. That's pretty bad. Here you have a husband and wife, and they're talking in the evening, and he says, honey, I've just been thinking about this thing. I know we've been tossing the idea around about going to the wedding in the next church over this weekend, but you know, they're having a work day at the school, and they're putting a new roof on the school. And last week, they were doing it too, but we had a family emergency, and we missed it. Everybody understands that, but if we just take off this weekend and go to a wedding, it's going to look kind of like we don't care. Okay. He says, I think maybe it'd be better to just stay home. She says, she pats him on the arm. Okay, honey, if that's the way you feel, if that's the leading you're getting on, that's fine. I'll stand behind you. It's all beautiful. Till the next morning when the 15-year-old daughter comes down and she's sitting there spooning her Wheaties and she says, the mom says, oh yeah, we're not going to the, what? We're not going to the wedding. But I'm a bridal table server. I've got the material already. The wedding's this weekend. What am I going to do? And the mom says, what am I going to do? And so what does she do? She throws her husband under the bus. She says, I agree with you. But You know, Dad, he is, we got to be respectful. We got to be, but I think you're right on this issue. I think he's gotten kind of barn sour. We can't drag him away from the place anymore. And, I don't know, but let's just try to be respectful. He is a dad. Hold on. And she just threw him under the bus. What do you think that's going to do for the 15-year-old's attitude in about 5 years? Okay. Here's a man. So the father, he wants to get his child out of school to go on a trip. And he goes and talks to the school teacher and he says, "Hey, do you think it'd be okay for me to get Betty out of school?" Teacher says, "Well, she's been gone a lot lately." And he's thinking, "Oh, yeah, I've pulled her out a lot lately. But she's getting behind on her grades. And I mean, you're the dad. You make the decision. But I would really prefer if you would just leave her in and just go this weekend to visit your relatives. And she could get her work caught up." Dad said, "Well, okay, yeah. Well, he's trying to figure out how to get out of here now. He says, "I just wanted to let you know that we really appreciate the work that you're doing on our children, and we really appreciate your Christian attitude and influence that you've given our children, the work you've put into them." And off he goes home. And he gets home, and his wife says, "What did he say?" He says, she has to stay home. Really? Why did he say? "I don't know. I mean, it's our child. I mean, who raised him? I remember paying the doctor bills, and he's sitting over there at the school, and he's just a teacher. He's just a hired helper, and now he's sitting over there and he's acting like the king, and no, you can't take your daughter out. I mean, what does he think he is anyway?" And so the school teacher gets thrown under the bus. And that's another shapeshifter. Okay, let's go to the shadow. The shadow is actually a side. It can be an external force that's trying to war on you. Satan could be a type of the shadow. But the way I want to look at it today, the shadow is our own dark nature that we have to deal with. You've probably heard the old classic story of Hide and Jingle. That's the basic idea. And Teddy's Button, if you've ever read that or listened to that story at Teddy's Button, that's sort of what it is. And this boy, he's going around getting into scraps and getting into trouble. And because his dad had been a great war hero, it's not our type of story exactly, but it's still quite the story. And he said he had been a great war hero and got killed in this famous charge. And the boy wants to be like his daddy. And so he's looking for a war. Everywhere he goes, he's getting into trouble. He's getting into scrapes. He's getting into trouble at church. And yelling at the girl in the pew right beside him, "I hate you!" And the minister said, "Well, that was one of the incidents. The girl at church kept harassing him, and finally he just couldn't take it anymore, and he jumped up and he screamed, 'I hate you!'" And so the minister said, "Why don't you come over to my place?" So he comes over to his place, and the minister says, "You know what, Teddy? What you really need? You need an enemy to fight." Teddy's like, "That's right. That's what I've been trying to tell everybody. That's what you need." He said, "I've got an enemy." "You do? Yeah. You wanna see him?" "Yeah, I guess." So he takes a tea towel and wraps it around his head or rag and ties his eyes shut. He said, "Come on this way." And he leads him through the house all the way back into the back corner of the house. "Teddy, do you want to see the enemy?" "Yeah." Yanks the thing off, and there's Teddy standing in front of a mirror. Well, we knew that was going to happen. He says, "Teddy, this is a problem." He says, "You were made to fight. But the thing you need to fight is what's coming out of you, the negative, the problems, the evil. That's what you were made to fight." And that is the idea. And I want to tell you a story that happened to me. This is embarrassing. It's still a little embarrassing. It happened over half a lifetime ago. It's too good to pass up because it exactly illustrates the point. The shadow is also taking our own negativity as maybe darkness and imposing it on other people. Like maybe I would choose the person right here and I would have a problem with anger or whatever. So I impose that on him. And then he becomes the enemy. And it's a very convenient way of me taking my problems and putting it on somebody else. And now I can get my sword out and chop them up. And I've dealt with the problem. And we're prone to it. Now, let me tell you this story. I was 16. So please remember that. Long time ago. 16. And I was out in the woods. Or 15. I think I was 16. I was out in the woods running this big Timberjack skidder. Big C-Series Commons. And it dueled out. And pulling logs out. And there was a four-man crew. It was me and my brother, Bevan, and Lamar and Jason. And we actually turned out to be a pretty good crew later on. But I was a little, very smart mouth. It's not hard to believe. One on the job. And I got myself into more trouble than it would have been strictly necessary. One time I was mouthing off at some of the... Let me see what time he got. At some of the men. And one of them grabbed me on each side, just picked me up, and flipped me upside down and walked over to the bank of a canal and walked down the canal. And they flipped, and I'm like, and I'm still making one last smart comment, you know. And I tipped my head. They said, Paul said, you need to look up, down. So I tipped my head back and the water was right there. And there's something a little bit about that that, nah, I might chill the smart comments for a little bit. And so I got myself into these sort of jams, and my brother Bevan could be really kind of sarcastic. And I was mad this day. And nobody was really saying that much on the radio that I remember. I mean, it might have been something once in a while, but I was angry because I was having a bad day. We have those days once in a while, and maybe a lot. And I was angry and jumping out of the skidder and chainsaw and studded up and cut the limbs off the tree and throw the saw back in the skidder, crawl up, get back in, drive, and go get the next skid. And the saw wasn't running right. And I hate pull start things. I have an electric weed trimmer today because you know how you pull and pull and pull and you go around in a circle and you get madder and madder. Anyway, this thing wouldn't start and I'm drop starting this big 0460 or whatever. It wasn't start. Finally, I broke the rope off, threw the saw back up in the skidder, climbed up in the skidder. And I told you it was going to be embarrassing. And I climbed up in the skidder and I was so angry that I started imagining I got to ask these men for help. Because I don't know how to fix this thing. But what are they going to say? Well, he's going to make this smart comment, and he might make this smart comment, and pretty soon I get this conversation going on in my head. Has any of you ever gotten one of those conversations going on in your head? You know, where you are. I mean, there's some company around here that'll relate. Maybe not to what comes next. But I was madder and madder, and I was, then they say this, and I say that, and I tell them off, and I'll just, finally, I got to the place where I was so worked up, and I picked up the radio, and I said, because these people have been making all these mean comments back to me, right? And said, hey, to all you wannabe Christians out there, would somebody tell me how to fix this stupid saw rope? Imagine dropping that bomb on somebody's peaceful morning. That's the shadow. It's when we take our own problems and we stick them on somebody else. And then they're the problem. Isn't that convenient? And that's where this relates so much to Christianity. Isn't that the struggle? So often in church problems, so often in marriages, so often I take my problems and I put it on her. Now it's her problem. Now I can kick her for it. Whatever. Not literally, but you know what I'm saying. We put our problems on somebody else. That's the shadow coming out. Wow, time is moving. This is good. I was afraid I was going to run out of stuff to say. The ally, there's two really beautiful stories. The ally is that person who has your back. In my case, it's my wife. It's a person who maybe will even bail you out of stuff that you very legitimately got yourself into. And they go, they either appear or they go with the hero through the hero's journey. And like my wife goes through life with me. And there's this story I like at David and Abishai when Saul's camp was down there and Abner, and they were all camped out in the valley. And David's like, I'm going to go down into Saul's camp. And I don't know if he asked for volunteers or what. And Abishai's like, I'm going along. Abishai is such an amazing character in the Bible. He's so bold. And so David and Abishai, and they go creeping down through all these sleep. And you know one of them's going to be awake. I mean, insomnia happened back then too, I suppose. And they walk, got all the way down to where Saul was. And Abishai says, here he is. He says, let me smite him, and I will not smite him again. No, Abishai would not need to smite somebody twice. He would do it right the first time. And David's like, no, no. And so Abishai, they get his water bottle and his spear, I think, and they walk back out of there. But that's your ally. the person who has your back. There's an even better story in some ways. And Jonathan and his armor bearer, and Saul's sitting there under the tree, and his army's leaving, and the enemy's right up there, the Philistines, and it's all falling apart on him. And Jonathan gets up. He's the hero of the story, the hero. And he goes out, and he takes his armor bearer with him. They come up to, I suppose it's like a rock, two faces of rock that go up to a plateau on higher ground. Well, that is a plateau. But anyway, goes on up. And the enemy's up on top. And Jonathan turns to his armor bearer and says something to the effect of, why don't we just yell up at them? And if they come down, we'll stand. And if they tell us to come up, we'll go up. And the armor bearer says, no, that's a bad idea. Nope, the armor bearer is a true ally. He said, you do what's on your heart to do and I'll cover your back, basically. He said, behold, I am with thee according to all that is in thy heart. What would we do without our allies? He's an amazing, we don't even know his name, but he's an amazing person. He stood behind Jonathan and they created a great victory for the Lord that day. We can't do it alone. And let's not think that we did it alone either. If something goes well for us, there was somebody holding our hand and covering our back. There really was. I don't care if you're a CEO of a big business. Somebody's sweeping the floor and cleaning the toilets. Somebody's making it work. You didn't do it all. So that's the ally. And last, we have the prankster or the trickster. And they're a call to change that lightens the mood by cutting the hero down to size or anybody else that needs cut back down to size. And they're a lot of fun. You put them in your story. They're the dry sense of humor, maybe, that just slices everybody off right at the knees when they need it. And it's a sense of humor in the writer. And even the hero might realize he's been cut off at the knees. And he thinks, oh, I so had that coming. I so had that coming through me. Let me give you two examples. One of them is the example of happened in our community. It's actually my father-in-law. And he was not that old, and he was walking down the road, and he saw a neighbor boy sitting there trying to put oil in the mower. And he said, oh, let me help you with that. So he comes over, and he's not, you know, like I say, he's not very old, but he comes over, and he says, oh, yeah, let me help you with that. So they go in the barn, and they look around. There's some oil, and he gets the oil jug down, and this looks like the right stuff. Goes back out and takes it off and pours it in. It's red. Oh, this must be red oil, you know, pouring it into the mower, and they check it, and yep, they got enough on the dipstick, and the other boy is like, oh, thank you, and oh, yep, no problem, or whatever he said, and off he went down the road. Well, next Monday at school, the children were talking as they do over lunch break, and they're saying, did you hear Donnie lock the mower up? Yeah, he put transmission fluid in the oil. And what does the boy do that stopped to help? He says, how can anybody be so stupid as to not realize the difference between transmission fluid and oil? He's forgetting his role here, and it wasn't long, because it was a neighbor girl that actually was the boy, brothers, and the boy that was pouring the oil, and it was his sister, and she turned around in her desk, and she pointed at him. She said, it was you who did it. The floor did not open up and swallow him. Those wonderful things only happen in fairy tales. Here's another example that can happen. I'll give you one more. Two little boys, hey, let's call them Ben and John, and they're sitting at the table, and one of them is tapping, is slurping, you know, slurping his milk, and the other one says, Ben, quit slurping your milk. I like slurping my milk. Quit slurping your milk. I don't have to. You're not the boss. Pretty soon, the mother hears slurp, 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 tap, 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 a spoon on a bowl rim. Quit tapping your spoon. I don't have to stop tapping my spoon. You're slurping. I'm tapping. I can do what I want. Stop it. All you have to do is turn your ears off. I like slurping. I like tapping. You turn your ears off. Back and forth. The mom can rush in there. Boys, it's just about time for school. And would you quit? And the little boy could turn and look at her and say, hey, we were late for school yesterday because you didn't have my shirt ironed. And then the mother's involved. So what the mother can do is she comes in and she says, because these boys are best friends, and comes in and say, "Boys, I'm so glad to see you having a wonderful time with eating breakfast with your best friend. And I know how fun it is to eat breakfast with your best friend, but if you don't get it done, you're going to be late for school." And they look at each other and kind of grin like, actually, we are best friends. And mama is kind of that way. So we covered all of them. I gave you another handout, and I don't have time for it. Basically, what this is, another way of creating realistic characters is by using such a book like Type Talk. And this would be a whole nother subject. It's another way of accurately portraying a person's character. You have extroverted and introverted. An extroverted is energized by people. He's the person that's hanging around the house and barely got enough energy, had a long day of work. His wife's like, "What's the matter? Am I boring, you know?" And then they get a call, "Hey, would you come over to your brother-in-law's house?" So they come over there and there's a big party going on. Next thing you know, he's in the middle of it and everything's, and he's all energized. And she's thinking, "What is wrong? I mean, just 10 minutes ago, he didn't have any energy at all." That's an extrovert. They draw their energy from people. And then introverts, they're the type who will get tired. They got to get away from people. They might be great with people when they're there, but they got to get away from people. And a lot of times I think writers are the personality types. They come to a weekend like this and they might have a great time, but then they need to just defrag, get away from it. And these people can really cause some misunderstandings between each other. There's a sense of sensing of intuitive. The sensing are the people that say what time it is, and they mean, "I want to know, is it 4:53? And the intuitive says, "Oh, it's about 4. Well, what time is it? It's about time to go." And the person's thinking, "Just tell me what time it is." Because sensing people tend to be very much in the here and now, what they can touch, what they can feel, smell, taste, and very present-oriented. Where the intuitives, they got their head in the clouds, they're great for tying all sorts of ideas together. That's where their genius lies. Meanwhile, if you set a chair in the aisle and they're walking through with their head in the clouds, they might trip over and fall on their face because, you know, they were thinking about something else and they weren't in the here and the now. There's thinking versus feeling. And this one is a major trap for our people, for people in general. And you'll get conversations that go like this. The thinking ones are the ones who primarily think in terms of the right, in terms of what is the principle of the matter. Where the feeling is, how is this going to affect people? Each of these are one versus the other. And you'll have conversations that run something like this, the thinker. "You know, I just think it's time that we dealt with Brother A's boy, because he's just not keeping the standard and he's not being respectful. And I think it's about time, it's setting a bad example for other people in the church. I think it's about time we dealt with it." And the feeler jumps right in. "Oh, you just don't, I mean, I know what you're saying, but the problem is he's had such a hard home life. And you're not taking that in consideration. I just get the feeling that if we just give him a little more time, that all this will work out." And the thinker says, "Look, we've already given him 6 months. I know we've got to take his feelings and all that into consideration. But finally, at the end of the day, somebody has to do something about this. I don't see why you can feel good just burying your hand in the sand and pretending like it's no problem." And the feeler says, "I'm not burying my head in the sand, but it seems like to me there's a whole lot of evidence and problems that he has to work through that you just take for granted because you came from a good home situation, and you're just taking all that for granted, and you don't have any feeling for the situation at all. I don't see how you can be so chop chop and just deal with it like that." He says, I'm not being chop chop, and you keep acting like these are my rules. These are the church." And you have these classic arguments. And it's a thinker versus a feeler. One of them is thinking in terms of this is the rule. The other one's thinking in terms of how's this going to affect the person. They might both come out at the same conclusion, but they'll arrive at it different ways. There's judging versus perceiving, which is a fascinating one. I'm an extreme right-wing perceiver, which basically means that the judges are the great ones at making decisions. They come into a room and they say, "What's going on here? Oh, well, we were trying to decide where to eat. Well, why don't we just eat at McDonald's? Does anybody else have a preference for anything else?" "Well, no, that's fine. Okay, let's eat at McDonald's." Meanwhile, the perceiver is the one standing there in front of the Kella and the aisle at Food Lion and trying to decide, do I buy this cereal or that one? And maybe even trying to make a moral case out of it. That's an extreme case. That's me, unfortunately. But you take all these four things and put them together. You could be an extroverted, intuitive, thinking, perceiving, and you push all this into one personality. So you have an EITP. Extroverted, intuitive, thinking, perceiving. And you take it and you put it all together and you arrive at a personality that can sometimes be frequency like your wife or your mother-in-law or your dad or you. And so when you go through a book like this, one way to do it is to try to go through and find a personality that matches the personality you want to use, or you could take the test and you could say, is he an extrovert, an introvert? You could go through. There's a better way to do it. If you have the book Type Talk, you can flip it over and it's got all 16 on the back. And each one has a little tagline that's been very carefully chosen for that personality. For example, ENTP is one exciting challenge after another. He's the one that's into scuba diving and airplane pilot and would like to climb Mount Everest, but he can't get to it this year. And then you have the INTP, and they're the problem solvers. And you have the one that the host and hostess of the world, hostess and hostesses of this world, and they're good at it. And you have the administrator, and you can find one that's close, and you can flip up to the index. Find that four-letter identifier, flip back, and you've got three pages or so of personality. What kind of clothes do they wear? How do they relate to other people? And it's all there. And that's how you could create a personality that was so real you could about know what they're going to say next, because it might actually be your father-in-law's personality, his real personality. Now, in real life, it's not quite that simple, because sometimes we're so close to the border between two of them, it's really hard to tell. I have a hard time telling on the E and the I. And then there's one other way to do it. You can start at the job and working towards a person doing the job. You can flip the book open to the jobs. You've got a list of jobs, type of people who would be good at or possibly end up in those jobs. And then look up that personality type. You might have three of them. Well, maybe you have three characters, that you want to all put in the same job. And you can go through and you can pull those three characters out and give them all real personalities, not just something you came up with, not a stereotype, but something real, a real person's personality. And if you pick a personality type of somebody who's really close to you, you might actually know what they're going to say next. Okay, I think we've got three minutes. Does anybody have any questions?
What about the friend you were going to tell us about in the beginning, your intellectual friend? Could you tell us more about him? He told us one with the goofy car, and then he said, now I'm going to tell you about another one.
He was the one that would reach behind the seat of his van and pull out.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I didn't make that clear, I guess.
I wasn't sure.
Yeah, that was him. I count him as a friend. He's one of those people that can tell you a lot about a lot. And it's great to have people like that in your life. Call them up and say, hey, what about Anabaptist history? What was going on in the... Well, and he starts in and I sit there down to listen, and it's interesting. It's like having an interactive encyclopedia at my phone. any more questions? We got 2 minutes yet.
This Type Talk book really intrigues me. Is that available on Amazon? Somewhere else good to get?
Everywhere. I would want to put in one pretty serious warning. They actually put a warning in the front of it too. You can look up your personality type and it'll say what your weaknesses are. Like this person is has a problem with waiting till the very last minute and then trying to crush everything in. And you can say, oh, that's my personality. Yep, that's just the way it is. Reality is, it is time to grow up. You know, it's time to plan ahead a little bit. Your weaknesses can't be justified simply because that happens to be that personality's weakness. And the other danger in it is trying to too closely categorize people around you, because even myself, having read the through the test how many times, one or two of them are so close that I had to wonder, really. So you read, like, let's say you're between ENTP and INTP. Read both of them, and you'll see a lot that matches in both. Because sometimes you're extroverting really strong, sometimes you're introverting really strong. But don't try to take it as a guidebook for your life, and especially don't try to take it as a way of justifying bad behavior. Mostly, I think it's great as a as a possible way of understanding people and as a way of getting really solid personalities for your books. Well, that's it. Thank you for being here and listening.